Hi there, and welcome to the 5th Annual Transforming Toddlerhood Conference. I'm so happy you're here with us today. I'm your host, Devin Kuntzman, toddler expert and founder of Transforming Toddlerhood. I'm on a mission to dispel the myth that toddlerhood is terrible and empower parents and caregivers to overcome the challenges of toddlerhood, nurture their little one's development, and create confidence in their parenting skills. And that's exactly what we're here to do today. And I am so excited to introduce you to Cecilia and Jason Hilke, founders and creators of Happily Family. Welcome, you two.
Thanks, Devin.
It is great to be here, Devin.
So happy to have you here today. And before we jump in about all things siblings and sibling relationships, could you just tell the audience a little bit about you and your work? Because they might not have met you before.
Sure.
So Jason and I are married. We have two teen children, but what most people know us for is that we have happilyfamily.com, and we run conferences similar to what Devin does here and her amazing work for parents. And before we even did that, we kind of our claim to fame was that we were preschool teachers in the same classroom when our kids were toddlers themselves. And And then I also have a background as an occupational therapist. So I have kind of a sensory integration kind of eye on things, as well as looking at development and teaching.
Yeah, I don't think I have anything to add to that.
Okay.
I love it. Well, what a great duo here. And I love to kick off these conversations by asking my speakers, what do you feel makes toddlerhood a challenging and oftentimes misunderstood developmental period?
We're recording our end, so you can go ahead and start whenever you want.
Yep. Okay. Looks like we're good. Everyone's recording. All right. Hi there, and welcome to the 5th Annual Transforming Toddlerhood Conference. I'm so happy you're here with us today. I'm your host, Devin Kuntzman, toddler expert and founder of Transforming Toddlerhood. I'm on a mission to dispel the myth that toddlerhood is terrible and empower parents and caregivers to overcome the challenges of toddlerhood, nurture their little one's development, and create confidence in their parenting skills. And that's exactly what we're here to do today. And I am so excited to introduce you to Cecilia and Jason Hilke, founders and creators of Happily Family. Welcome, you two.
Thanks, Devin.
It is great to be here, Devin.
So happy to have you here today. And before we jump in about all things siblings and sibling relationships, could you just tell the audience a little bit about you and your work? Because they might not have met you before.
Sure.
So Jason and I are married. We have two teen children, but what most people know us for is that we have happilyfamily.com, and we run conferences similar to what Devin does here and her amazing work for parents. And before we even did that, we kind of our claim to fame was that we were preschool teachers in the same classroom when our kids were toddlers themselves. And And then I also have a background as an occupational therapist. So I have kind of a sensory integration kind of eye on things, as well as looking at development and teaching.
Yeah, I don't think I have anything to add to that.
Okay.
I love it. Well, what a great duo here. And I love to kick off these conversations by asking my speakers, what do you feel makes toddlerhood a challenging and oftentimes misunderstood developmental period?
Well, first thing I'll say is I think so often we hear the terrible twos, and that's just something that I like to dispel. Is I don't think there is such a thing as a terrible twos, and I think that's one myth that I'd like to dispel, and that it's actually my favorite time. The 2, 3, 4, 5 year olds are my favorite time with kids. So that's one thing that I personally would like to start to dispel that myth.
Yeah, it's such a wonderful period of development, because you get kids with all of this brand new autonomy and independence, and they've realized, wait, they're coming out of infancy. They're like, wait, I'm different than mom and dad. I have legs. I can like run around. I can say no. They have all of this power. And that is so amazing. It's like a superpower. And then also to help parents understand how they can get their needs met while also meeting the needs of their child is challenging, but wonderful. And helping parents and toddlers understand how they can regulate their own emotions, because that's also something that happens in toddlerhood, is these big feelings come out, and parents can often feel like, oh my gosh, what do I do if my child screams in the grocery store, or, you know, has a fight with their younger sibling or their older sibling, and how do I help that? So there's really wonderful, exciting, but also very challenging times. So it's very exciting.
Yeah, actually, I'll underscore that by saying, as they're developing this autonomy, and also they're more mobile, what's interesting is that we as the parents are making that transition ourselves from where the kids were completely dependent on us, right? Like, we were providing everything for them. We could just put them in the little carrier and take them with us, strap them on us. Everything we did, they did with us.
And they were happy to
They were perfectly happy. They didn't have a choice. Actually, they're so small, right? They really couldn't get around very much. And we're going through, in that toddler stage, going through that transition to a kid who really starts to have their own will and is so much more mobile and is able to do so much more. And we, as the parent, are starting to having to figure out that transition. Both, I recognize now that my child does not want to go somewhere, and it becomes more and more difficult to try to figure out how to get them to go with me rather than just throw them in the carrier. And there's like that, like you were saying, that autonomy that's happening. So there's like this development, this brain development that's happening where they're starting to recognize, like, oh, hey, I'm different than you. I can have different ideas, different choices. It's not just you that's getting to choose this stuff. I'm also going to start exerting my own will into this. So it's a real interesting transition for parents. And I think there's some like key ones in the development of kids that really challenges us as parents, because we're going through these changes too. It's not just the kids. And I think we're so focused on the changes the kids are going through that we forget that we as the parent also are going through changes, and we're learning and we're trying to figure this stuff out. And most of the time we've not done this before, or we haven't done it with, you know, if it's a sibling, we haven't done it with this one. This one's different. Or we haven't done it with two, or we haven't done it with three. Like, it's new each time. So it's sometimes tough for us to give ourselves a little bit of a break and realize, like, oh, look, I'm figuring this out too, and I'm going through a transition.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I always say that the overarching goal of the toddler years is for your little one to become their own individual and to really develop a sense of self. And this happens as they realize that they're not really an extension of their parents and primary caregivers, that they are, in fact, their own person that can do their own things. And this is why we see toddlers just have such strong preferences in the toddler years, because they, for the first time, they realize that they can have these likes and dislikes, and they have their own agenda. And oh my goodness, is it challenging to have your little one with their own agenda seemingly out of nowhere, and it does not align with your agenda. And then that's where the challenges really come in. And today, I know we're talking about building sibling relationships, and I just want to start off by asking you, at what age do you feel that parents and caregivers should really start thinking about sibling relationships and sibling dynamics?
Yeah, honestly, I think it could happen before that second child is born or that second child is adopted, that you can start laying some of that foundation very early on, at least in talking about becoming maybe a big brother or a big sister. Beyond that, certainly after there are two kids, what I like to think about is the older child, your first child, they have never lived in a world where they've had to share you with other people, other siblings. So it's really kind of it's the biggest transition for this first child that you have. Whereas the second child coming along, they're being born into a world or adopted into a family where they already have a sibling. So really maintaining that strong, secure attachment with your first child so that you preserve that relationship that you have with them and they feel safe and seen and soothed by you. My own mom, I'm the second, I'm actually the middle child, but my own mom would talk about how she would leave me, the younger sibling, in my crib, and I would be perfectly content as a little baby. And she would spend time with my big brother because he was the one that needed it rather than me. So I think that's a nice thing to keep in mind when introducing a new sibling into the family, is to that this the biggest transition is for the first child, because it's so easy to get wrapped up in the needs of a baby too, and the care and the constant like feeding and tending and catching up on sleep, and that is so intense. but don't forget the first child.
Yeah, and we're making a little bit of an assumption here that the older siblings probably toddler-ish age. So you know, we're not necessarily talking about an older sibling, much older sibling, but like if the older sibling is more toddler-like or toddler age, I think it's super valuable, like you were saying early on, before the baby is born, is to spend that time and develop that really strong foundation, going on one-on-one dates with the oldest with the one toddler, and developing that relationship so they feel really tight and safe and secure and seen. That attachment is really a foundation that is laid before the baby comes along, because there's going to be a lot of time spent, obviously, with the baby. And then the other thing is also to involve the oldest sibling in the whole process and have them feel like they're a part of it, because then they will see that they are a piece of this family and not just an external piece or something that's competing with, but rather they are they're integral into the, you know, the care and the feeding and the diaper changing and the playing with and all of these things that they can do. And it, you know, of course, depends on the age of the older sibling, but to be able to involve them, hey, can you grab me that diaper over there and bring it over and we'll change that. You know, like there's some things they're going to be able to do more than others, but as much as we can involve them in that process, then they feel included and it reinforces that attachment rather than it being a competition with the younger sibling.
Such a great point. And I, you know, there's so many parents and caregivers asking in my community, asking all the time about this, that I actually created a workshop called Toddler Meets Baby a few months ago to really support parents during this transition of when you bring a little one home or prepare to bring a little one home when you have a toddler. And it's just so great to think about, you know, like it's not even, we have so much power, I think, when it comes to supporting the relationship and supporting the how the relationship's going to go and laying that foundation, and that it can even happen before a little one comes home, before a sibling comes home, that work can really get started. And I would love to know, like, when you just think about sibling relationships, especially into the toddler years, what are some of the common traps or that parents fall into when it comes to these relationships?
Yeah. Sure, yeah. I think one of the biggest common traps, I'll talk about maybe two, is parents deciding how our conflict is going to get worked out. Like parents assuming like, I've got the big picture. I know how to create things and I'll make it fair. And I'll be kind of like the judge and the jury and everything combined. And here, you get this toy for 5 minutes and then you can get it for 5 minutes and I'll come up with a solution, rather than this amazing opportunity we have with even very young, maybe it's even a baby and a toddler, to come together and to find out what is going to work for both people here, even though they're little people. So that's one thing. And we can talk more about specifically how we handle conflict in the future. And then the second thing that I think parents can get trapped into is when there's a conflict, that sometimes, and I can certainly include myself in her too, when there's a conflict, I get flooded, I get triggered, and it's really hard for me to be very present to what's happening because I'm wrapped up in all my own emotions. And so figuring out what I need to do to take a few deep breaths, calm myself first. I even remember when my kids were fighting outside one time, and I locked myself in the bathroom just to give myself a moment, knowing like they're going to be okay. Like they're in a safe place. I need to take a little bit of time for myself. So I took maybe 10 seconds, locked myself in there to just give myself a moment to calm myself down. And then I could go out and be a better parent for them.
The only other trap I would add to that, or a pitfall, is sometimes we as parents get caught up in what's fair. And we hear this often asked of us, is like, well, how do I figure out what's fair? And the kids are saying, that's not fair. And what we talk about often is fair versus equal. And what usually kids are saying is, that's not equal. They're getting that and I didn't get that. And what we talk about in our family and we coach other parents with is being a family that's fair. And a family that's fair, we associate it with medicine, for instance. If one kiddo is sick and another one's, you know, perfectly healthy, we wouldn't give them both medicine. We give the child that needs the medicine what they need, and we don't give it to the other one. That would be equal. If we gave it to both of them, that'd be equal. But it's fair that the one that's sick is getting the medicine. In much of the same way, as a parent, we look at how we're going to be parenting a child that's, our kids are different, and we're not going to be treating them the exact same way. One rule, one agreement, one limit that we may have with one child may not apply to another one, because that's what's fair. That's what that child needs. That's who that child is. If it was equal, then it would be the same for everyone. Rules would be rules, and that's it. And that doesn't make a lot of sense, because not all kids are equal. And so I think that's a trap that we as parents get kind of locked into. We start thinking about like, how can I make all this fair, and everything needs to be the same, and it actually doesn't. And if we're easy on ourselves and we recognize like, no, we give the kids what they need, and that's what's fair.
Yeah, I love that. And it's such a common phrase to hear, especially from an older sibling that, you know, has better command of words. If you're thinking of like maybe having like a 1-year-old and a 3 or 4-year-old at home, or a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, it's a really common phrase to hear. So I love that this is a way that parents can really reframe what they're hearing and translate it into something that's more supportive for everyone. What would you say are just some of the things that parents and caregivers can do to really build that firm foundation in the sibling relationship? Even when, you know, both kiddos are, you know, maybe there's two toddlers and they're both running around and have their own agendas, what's a way that parents can really focus on building that foundation, that relationship, especially inside of what feels like a lot of chaos at the same time?
Yeah. And I also just want to say, like, to everyone who's listening, we understand that there's a lot of chaos that is happening in houses when there are young kids or older kids. And so we have a ton of compassion for that. And remember days in the preschool classroom when we would just look at each other and be like, oh my gosh, what is happening? We have like 21 3- to 5-year-olds. And what are we going to do? So in the midst of those full, emotionally draining, like packed, exciting days, one of the things that I think really builds a strong sibling foundation is how we help kids handle conflict. I really like to look at conflict when I can calm myself down and not get triggered by my own emotions. I really like to look at conflict as this opportunity to grow. It's an opportunity to connect and to understand each other better. And really, like, families are a place where we learn how to get along with each other. It's such an incredible opportunity. So reframing conflict and helping kids figure out how to get through conflict. And we could, should we share some steps about how to do conflict?
Sure, right, I think that'd be great.
Okay.
First, I want to say, like, yeah, this is easy for us to talk about. And the truth of the matter, at least for me, was that conflict in the family just gets my hair on top. And it really gets me like going, like I get really agitated and it really gets me fired up. And it's been something I've always struggled with when the kids were fighting. But when I was teaching in the classroom and I saw kids fighting, of course they're not my kids, so it didn't get me as triggered. But I also got to see in the classroom this opportunity to see it as a place or an opportunity for growth. And that was interesting for me. And when I saw that, I was then able to take that and translate that into our home. And so I just want to acknowledge for parents that, like, it really, when there's conflict with our kids, just to acknowledge, like, that's very triggering for us as a parent versus with other kids. And that if we can start to slowly transition into that place of seeing it as an opportunity for growth and an opportunity for connection, it really is transformative for us as a parent, but also for the kids. But I also want to say it's not easy. I think Cecilia is way better at it than I am. She continues to be better at it than I am, but it is something that I think can be really challenging for some parents.
Yeah, I always say practice makes progress. And so it truly is a practice, and it's not going to look perfect, and it's going to grow and evolve. But the good news is we don't have to have it all figured out every moment. And it's about just seeing like what worked and what didn't. Give yourself a little bit of compassion, learn the lessons, and try again, because that's the best we can do, is just to keep trying again as we learn and grow.
Totally. Yeah. Do you want to say those steps that you were starting to lead into the steps?
Sure. We could come up with an example and talk about some steps. Would that be helpful for your audience?
Yeah, Devin? I think that'd be great. That's a great place to start for us to address conflicts. I know a lot of people have questions on what to do, especially around things like, you know, grabbing toys or, you know, hitting, things like that. There's endless scenarios for sibling conflict.
Yeah.
Yes. Many opportunities to practice.
Yes. Lots of opportunities every day. So let's think of a scenario where, like, maybe there's a toddler and there's an infant, and the toddler goes and, like, pulls the infant's hair. And that's really triggering for a lot of parents. Anytime that there's any sort of, like, hitting or biting or hair pulling or kicking, it often evokes us a lot as parents. So as we said before, I think the first step, and you might only have a half of a second to do this, but the first step is really, like, checking in with yourself and doing whatever you can to calm in the moment. Maybe it's saying something to yourself that you've heard us say here today or heard Devin say before, of, like, that conflict is not an opportunity to grow, or that we're going to work this out, or something that's kind of calming, taking a deep breath, getting a drink of water, whatever it is that can quickly kind of get you grounded, and help then for you to transition into helping get your kids safe. So as you're doing your self-calming, so that's step number one, is kind of checking in with yourself, and you can jump in here if you want to add.
It's okay.
Step number two after that is creating some safety for the kids. So oftentimes, what that means for me with young ones is that I'll, like, put an arm around each of them so that they both feel a little connected to me. If we have a baby, or if a child doesn't have a really great command of language, then I'm going to do some of the speaking for them so that they can be represented in this conflict. So I might say something like, "How? That hurt when you pulled my hair. That's what the baby's saying from crying, saying, she didn't like that." And then for the older child might say something like, "Oh, hey, I want that toy. I want that rattle that the baby has." "Oh, okay. You really want the rattle." And, like, having a conversation, having a dialogue with both of them so that, both sets of needs are brought to the table. I'm understanding their feelings, like, that the baby is hurt, and also probably talking with the toddler about, "Oh gosh, you're really frustrated. You want that rattle. You really like that rattle that the baby has. Okay. How are we going to work this out?" So kind of step three would be trying to figure out some solutions. If the toddler, or if the kids can't figure out any solutions that are going to work, or if there are no solutions that they're coming up that are going to work for me, then I'm going to offer some of my own. Like, "What about if you give this toy to the baby and we'll see if she lets go of the rattle? Let's try that," and try a little bit of negotiation to figure out something that will work for both of them. So that's a really
brief. Or how about what do you think about if you tapped on my arm and said, "Hey, I'd like that"? Or if you tapped on the baby's arm and said, "I want that," but, like, really giving them other ideas that would meet our need as a parent for safety and the baby's need for comfort, and meet the need for the child of communicating what it is they're trying. Because that's what they're pulling the hair, they're hitting, they're kicking. Usually it's a form of communication. And that's what we're trying to do, is to help them find another way to communicate that is meeting everyone's needs.
Yeah. And I like what you talked about, because I was focusing more on, like, what can we do in the moment to solve this problem? And you were focusing on how we want a role model for kids in the future that they can solve those similar situations. So I like both of those.
And one of the reasons we talk about this so much, and we spend time in doing this with kids when they've got the conflict. And this isn't fast. I mean, this is something that's going to take a little bit of time, right? Like, if we really want a fast conclusion or a fast solution, we all know what to do in those cases. I don't think anyone needs examples of that, right? But when we're trying to do it like this and make it a little bit slower, people are like, "Well, yeah, it just takes so long. I don't have time for that. I'm busy. I got to do this and this. And why would I want to spend all the time doing this?" And the reason is because if we're considering that we're building this foundation and scaffolding them in how to problem solve and scaffolding them into how to have their own conflict resolution, we are actually building a skill for both of them so that in the future, down the line, they don't need us to always be there to resolve conflict. And they don't need us to be there every moment, every time something comes up. Because what will start to happen is not only will they find a different way of interacting that isn't involving us, but if there is some kind of a conflict, that they start to be able to work it out. Now, obviously with an infant, that's going to take a lot longer, but when it's two toddlers, they learn very quickly like, oh, hey, This has already been modeled for us with mom and dad. They've shown us, or our caregiver has shown us how to do this, and they will start to do it themselves. So it's really worth spending that a little bit extra time because it pays off in the long run. It really does. And sometimes that's hard as a parent who's really busy to keep in mind that it's worth spending that little bit extra time.
Yeah, I mean, teaching skills is one of the most important aspects of discipline. I feel like I have a three-step recipe for effective discipline that I teach a lot of people in my community, and teaching skills is definitely one of them because it's like the gift that keeps on giving, you know, and we might not see the full benefit of it in this moment, but when we fast forward down the road, then we have a child who has the ability to work through conflict and solve problems, and two kiddos that are able to do that together without having us involved every time, which can be so supportive. And, you know, when it comes to these challenges, it takes some guidance. It takes some time to work through it with kiddos, especially when they're young in the toddler years and really lacking that impulse control. And as you said, like, it can be super triggering for us as the adults. And one thing that I notice is a lot of times parents and caregivers, and I've done this as well, kind of fall into the habit of making one child the good one, typically the younger one or the one they feel is a little like more helpless or something like this, and one child the quote unquote bad child, which is typically the older one who, you know, quote unquote should know better, or is old enough to know better. And I'm curious your thoughts on why we should avoid, you know, looking at it through this lens and placing these labels on the kiddos when it comes to kind of solving this conflict and teaching them skills for the future.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Our perspective is that whenever there's like hitting or biting or hair pulling or whatever, that's the last resort that a child is using. Like they don't want to use those strategies, but they've tried everything that they can think of doing. And especially if you're a young child, you don't have very many tools in your toolbox. So lashing out and physically trying to do something to solve your problems, it can almost seem like the first resort for parents that are looking at a child like, oh my gosh, why is he hitting again? Or why is she hitting again? So understanding like, that these little guys are doing the best they can with what they have, and that when they know better, that they'll do better. And if they feel good about their relationship with us, and when they feel good about themselves, then they're much more able to have some impulse control and have more patience. But if they're tired or hungry or lonely, or angry, then especially in those times, then you do get behaviors that are harder for kids to manage. So I think first, when you see one kid is like the good kid and one kid is the bad kid, understanding that those behaviors are like a tragic attempt to meet a need. They're really trying hard. They don't know what else to do. And it's our parenting, our support, and other caregivers' parenting and support that's going to help them build the skills so that they don't have to do that in the future.
And I think what some parents have said to us is that it's hard for them. Like it just naturally is there. It's like immediate. They're like, I feel like I can't help myself. And I just see like one seems like they're the one who's causing all the problems. And I just fell into this like the good child, bad child kind of like judgment. And one of the things that we suggest is to be regularly going on one-on-one dates with your kid, like have one-on-one time with them. And maybe that's just, you know, as a toddler, maybe that's just spending some time playing Legos with them without the sibling around, that it's just your time, and your goal during that time is just to connect. And that builds that foundation of relationship with them, not just for their sake, but also for your sake as a parent, because you start to see them differently. We start to have a different view of them. And to be able to do that with both of them helps in developing that attachment with the parent, which actually helps in the relationship between the siblings, because they're no longer trying to compete for our attention or our relationship, but then all of a sudden they're more comfortable with being with each other. So it's a little counterintuitive. People don't quite get that usually. And it's not something you immediately think of, like, oh, I should spend more time with each of them separately so they get along better. But it really does help in that attachment model.
And I think, does it also help with how we view our child too? Yeah, that's, like when we're
that's kind of
them.
What I was hinting at. Yeah. Our image of that child starts to shift, because we start to see, oh, you know, they're trying the best they can, that, and this is their challenge that they've got, or, oh, now I see their perspective. It just gives us a different view of them, and it helps develop our attachment to them and our relationship with them as well.
Like seeing that child for who they really are, seeing the gold in them, seeing their superpowers, reframing stubbornness, or what looks like defiance. It's like, wow, my child is very persistent, or they're very assertive. Constantly looking at how am I viewing that child? Because those thoughts that we have about our kids, even if we don't articulate them out loud, they come across to our children. And in the classroom, it was part of our work was to really understand what made the tough kids tick, the kids that were more behaviorally challenging. Certainly we were doing that in our own home too, but it was those kids that were really, really tough. Like we just had to like understand them and love them even more so that we didn't get into that trap of thinking, oh, that's the bad kid. So yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. A great tool I like to share with parents is just to practice looking for the good. So, you know, really practice looking for the behavior that you want to see, because the more that we focus on that behavior and can find it, the more often we'll see it. Because a lot of times it doesn't mean that it's not happening, but because the behavior that we typically don't want to see can feel so triggering, it just somehow like automatically in our mind erases all those other moments where things were going well. And so I always like to make it a point to find that behavior that we want to see and, you know, really look at how we can shift the lens out of, you know, labeling one child good or bad, or one as like the aggressor or the victim. Because, you know, what I found is that whenever we really focus on those roles, not only do kids pick up on it, it tends to reinforce those roles. So then kids kind of start to feel stuck and like, you know, the one that is like the good child, or maybe like the victim, and then somehow like thinks, well, gosh, there's nothing I can do to have this go differently. And then the other child is like, oh, well, I guess this is just how I deal with things. And I just feel like that, you know, the more that we can shift our lens in these moments and just practice slowly shifting this lens, then the easier it's going to be for everyone to navigate the conflicts that come up.
Yeah, there was an exercise I've done over many times during the lifetime of being a parent at different ages with our kids to kind of combat that negative bias that we have, that negativity bias where you were just describing of where that one thing that happens as negative just blows out like all the good that's happened, right? We're just like, it's all we get stuck on. It's like, oh, it's so terrible. And it's just been this one piece compared to everything else. And I started for an extended period of time, I would wake up in the morning and the first things I would go through were positive things that I had seen my child do, and just practicing that and developing a habit of that. And that was something that, and I would, when they got older, I would actually just, you know, kind of comment to them like, hey, I noticed that you did such and such the other day, and just like communicating that with them. Cause most likely, especially as they're getting older, they know when we've got that kind of that negative view of them. And if we're starting to give them that positive feedback, that also helps to reinforce how we feel about them in our relationship. And so that was an exercise I took on for a while and have done that, needed to do that a few times over the years.
Yeah, that's so supportive. And I'm curious, when I know for myself, like I'm a very linear thinker. And so I know what really helps for a lot of people with a toddler and sometimes a baby at home or multiple toddlers at home is to kind of be able to kind of map out what everyone's role is. And I just would love for you to talk a little bit about, or like underscore, like if we're looking at all the tips and all the things you've talked to us about today, what do you feel the parent's role really is inside of the sibling conflict?
That's a really interesting question. I think the parent's role is making sure that both of the kids' voices are heard. Whether that's the younger child who doesn't have as good of a grasp on language, making sure that voice is heard, or maybe it's the older child that we are having an expectation like, come on, you're older, you can like have more flexibility, you can give up yourself a little bit more, but being able to like support them, and maybe something just really isn't working for them. That it's okay for them to not feel like they have to give up all the time to accommodate the younger child. So I think it's helping both of those voices be heard so that we really can come up with a solution that's going to work for both. Some of the things that we would say in our family when our kids were young, especially, is that you guys don't have to give up yourself for this. We're a family. We figure out what's going to be a win-win for everyone. What are your ideas? How can we find out something that's going to work for both of you and for me, us parents too?
Yeah. Win-win solutions, I think, are like one of the keys that we as parents need to bring to the conversation. And at the core of that is the needs that everyone's needs are being met. There's a lot of other things we could talk about, but that's like, if there was one that I'd pull away from, that's win-win solutions.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. And you know, after conflict comes the opportunity to apologize and move on. And it's important for a lot of parents and caregivers to feel like siblings have made amends or somehow apologize. And I'm curious, what are your tips for helping parents support kids in making amends with each other, but in a way that is authentic and not just more robotic because they have to.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a big topic that we hear often.
Yeah. And I love that you asked us about this because it's something I feel really passionate about, that I don't think forced apologies do anybody any good. We're actually just teaching our kids it's okay to lie.
Building resentment, maybe. It does a good job.
Yeah. Building resentment. So robotic apologies are not what we're wanting. Well, I think what we're wanting as parents and caregivers is for our kids to reflect on what happened and to think, what could I have done differently? What do I wish I had done? If I could like go back in time in a time machine, to think about that. So that's, I think, one of the other roles that we have as parents is helping our kids think about what happened in a conversation, not in like you're in a timeout, go think about, you know, what you would do differently next time way, because kids that are in timeouts, they aren't going to think about that. They're just going to be like mad at their parents that put them in the timeout or trying to figure out how to like be more sneaky next time. But in a dialogue way of like, if we could go in a time machine, what would you do differently? Or what could you do next time you want the toy that your brother or sister has? So them thinking about alternatives, I think it's part of it. And then whatever small act that they can do, if they tore the page of the book, maybe they can put tape on that page that they tore, that the book that belonged to their sibling. If they can draw a picture and give that picture to their sibling to reconnect, like a small gesture.
Yeah. And I think the role that we're trying to do in in Amends is we're building empathy, right? We're working with them to try and put themselves in the other person's place. And at the toddler years, that's a tough thing for them doing. That's one of their skills they're building. That's what they're figuring out is like, oh, what they're experiencing is different than what I'm experiencing, because for much of their life, they just think everyone's experiencing the same thing and understands the same thing I understand it. And it's everyone's everyone. And this is something where we're needing to support them in developing that empathy. So we can start to do things like, you know, if someone falls down, maybe if they push the kids, their sibling down and they scrape their knee, like, oh, hey, quick, go grab an ice pack, bring it on over here and we'll take care of that. Like having them be a part of trying to support their sibling in feeling better or healing or doing whatever it might be. Those small acts can help them start to see like what their impact has been on the other sibling. And then the probably one of the things that I think we forget as parents is we can role model for them when things happen with us and them. And if I do something that I'm like, wow, I wish I would have done that differently. I wish I wouldn't have, you know, yelled before we left trying to get out the door because no one had their shoes on. I wish I wouldn't have yelled. And so I can come back outside that moment, maybe later in the day, and say, you know, guys, earlier in the day when we were trying to leave, and I remember when I yelled and because no one had their shoes on, I wish I could have done that differently. And like actually role model for them what it looks like to have amends. And we noticed this. We actually heard this and saw this happen with our kids where we, you know, things like this would happen as a parent. We do things we wish we would have done them differently. We have regrets, we have amends that we make. And we heard our kids start to apologize to each other spontaneously using the same format that we were using with them because they had had it role modeled and they had the words and they knew like how that would play out and what they would do. So I think we as parents need to remember that we can be a really big piece of that puzzle when it happens with us and to remember that, like, hey, we're fallible in the same way. We can make mistakes and we can apologize for them too. And it's good for the kids to see that.
Yeah, that's such a great point that, you know, one of the best ways to really model these types of, to teach these type of skills is through modeling them. And so this is a really great point. And, you know, I always say that, you know, for a child to apologize to another child, we really have to help them feel better before they can help someone else feel better. So if that child is still upset about what happened, you know, like if a child hit another child, the one who hit, if they still have, like maybe the child that got hit has a physical hurt, but maybe the child who did the hitting has more of an emotional hurt or need there. And if we haven't soothed and supported that, then it's going to be really hard for them to authentically, you know, help another child feel better. And so I think like this further just underscores, you know, why it's not just, it's important to get away from this idea of like labeling one child as good and one child as bad, because in that situation, both kids are having a hard time or having some type of hurt. And so we've got to address both of those. Like you said, we have to hear both children's voices. And I think that's so important if we ever want to get to more of an authentic apology.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So for parents and caregivers at the beginning of their journey, thinking about building strong sibling relationships, what's one action step that they can take today just to really start out on their journey and move the needle forward?
Yeah. And when you say starting out on their journey, are you saying like with a young child or that they're kind of like new to this kind of peaceful parenting, or maybe even both?
It could be both, but more so new to the idea of that. I hear what you're saying. This is such an important topic and I want to make a difference in my children's relationship and really start focusing on how to support them to really build that strong relationship. So where would you recommend that they get started?
Yeah. If there's not a conflict that's happening, I think one of the easiest things to do, and there's a couple of reasons why it's beneficial to do it, is I love Dan Siegel's frame it. He used to say name it to tame it. Now he says name it to frame it, which is basically when we name emotions that we're having or that our kids might be having, that it helps calm down. Actually, neurologically helps calm down the amygdala, the emotional centers of our brain. So that's one reason why we want to do that. The second reason is that It also builds our emotional vocabulary, builds our kids' emotional vocabulary. So that's an easy way to start incorporating some of these concepts that we've been talking about here and in the conference in your daily life. So that could be as simple as you have an infant that is pre-verbal, you're changing their diaper, they start to cry, and you're saying, oh, this feels uncomfortable. You don't like all that cold air on your bum. Here, we're going to do this, and then we're going to make sure that you are nice and comfortable. Talking about their feelings. For the child who's hit the other sibling, oh, that you are so angry. You really want that toy. This didn't go the way you wanted it to. And to the other child that got hit, ow, that hurts so bad. You're feeling really hurt. So again, it helps calm down our emotional brain and helps build the emotional vocabulary.
It also helps build our empathy for our kids, because we start to put ourselves into their shoes. We're like, oh, what are they feeling? And it's modeling for them having empathy for each other. So those are the empathies, one of the keys in what we teach about parenting. And this is a nice way to be able to do that.
And I would say also, do that for yourself. Yeah. Like, name what feeling is happening for yourself. Like, oh, I'm feeling really frustrated because we're trying to get out the door and nobody has their shoes on. I'm feeling anxious. This isn't working for me. Having that calming, soothing self-talk, naming emotions, is a really great place to start.
Yeah, I love it. I typically recommend for parents and caregivers to start with themselves, especially if they find themselves having trouble doing it for their kiddos. It oftentimes means that we haven't already done it for ourselves. And there's, I think, just so much to be gained when we take that time to kind of walk ourselves through our feelings and emotions, because we're human too. And our feelings and emotions are just as valid as everyone else's. And I think sometimes we tend to forget that as parents and caregivers, and you know, our own needs and feelings and emotions kind of get pushed down or go to the wayside. And so that's such a powerful first step, I feel, that everyone can take. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
So, you know, our time's coming to a close. I'm just curious if there's anything else you'd like to add or any final words of wisdom you'd like to leave us with about sibling relationships.
Well, actually, it's along the lines of what you were just saying, that it's so important for us as a parent to be taking care of ourselves. And I think we forget that, especially when we're really busy, when the kids are young and there's lots going on. And I think part of that is understanding how to find calm for ourselves and calm for the kids. Because, you know, we really don't want the kids to have to rely on us for absolutely everything, right? So the more we can model and the more tools we can put into place so they don't need us, the easier our load becomes. And also the more that we're able to identify for ourselves, how can we find some calm in the midst of all the craziness. So one of the things that we'll have here also available for you is a calming plan. We make that available to the people here in the conference. And it's a free plan to go through for everyone. And if this is for like everyone in the family, to go through and to fill out, like, what are the things that make you feel calm? And it's not about, I mean, there's lots of great examples in it so that you don't have to think of it all by yourself just with a blank slate. But what's great about it is there's lots and lots of examples. And for me, like, what helps calm me is listening to music and going for a walk, getting outside. Sometimes I can do that. Sometimes I can't. The other things that help calm me is just some nice cool water on my face. And I can identify those things. And each person in the family makes that list of what calms them, put it on the fridge. And then when we're like kind of like getting a little triggered or a little upset and we want to calm, we, the adult, can go and look. Or if our kids need it, they can go and look. Or we can prompt them to say, hey, remember that calming list thing we put together? And it's on the fridge. Why don't you go check that out? And it can be made with pictures, so it's not just words. So whatever it works for them to be able to read. And maybe there's a basket that has the things in it. Maybe they like a feather or maybe a ball to squeeze or something that they've identified as being calming for them. That is so pivotal for them to be able to start to identify and build a skill around how to calm themselves, because then they don't need us as much. Not only can they help calm themselves, but they can go and figure out the things that calm themselves, because you guys did the work and you created this calming plan. So that's one thing that I would highly suggest putting into place, kind of like a foundation. That's just a nice, easy thing to do. It can be connecting as a family, and it's great for the kids to see, like, oh, hey, this applies to mom and dad too, or my caregivers. Like, they need it just as much as I do. And this is great. And I remember our kids reminding us of like, hey dad, maybe you want to check out your calming plan. So it's actually really nice to kind of level the playing field for everyone in the family. And obviously it's very useful.
I love that. It's so generous. And I know that everyone's going to really appreciate that. And before we go, can you just let us know where everyone can find you if they want to continue the conversation?
Sure. The easiest way is our website. So happilyfamily.com, happily family, like happily ever after. And you can find out everything about us and courses and a lot of free content that we have in there.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I just want to thank you both for taking the time to be here today and to share all of your wisdom and expertise with us all. I truly appreciate you and the work that you're doing in this world.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. It's great to be here.
It's great to be here.
Thank you. And before I go, I'd like to invite all of you to join the discussion thread for this session in the Transforming Toddlerhood Facebook group. We'd love to hear your thoughts, questions, and feedback. Can't wait to connect with you there. And don't forget to upgrade to the premium package so you can access the bonus materials for the conference and listen to this session and all the others again and again. Well, until next time, we'll see you soon. Bye.
First thing I'll say is I think so often we hear the terrible twos, and that's just something that I like to dispel, is I don't think there is such a thing as a terrible twos. And I think that's one myth that I'd like to dispel, and that it's actually my favorite time. The 2, 3, 4, 5 year olds are my favorite time with kids. So that's one thing that I personally would like to start to dispel, that myth.
Yeah, it's such a wonderful period of development because you get kids with all of this brand new autonomy and independence. And they've realized, wait, they're coming out of infancy. They're like, wait, I'm different than mom and dad. I have legs. I can like run around. I can say no. They have all of this power. And that is so amazing. It's like a superpower. And then also to help parents understand how they can get their needs met while also meeting the needs of their child is challenging, but wonderful. And helping parents and toddlers understand how they can regulate their own emotions, because that's also something that happens in toddlerhood, is these big feelings come out and parents can often feel like, oh my gosh, what do I do if my child screams in the grocery store, or, you know, has a fight with their younger sibling or their older sibling, and how do I help that? So there's really wonderful, exciting, but also very challenging times. So it's very exciting.
Yeah, actually, I'll underscore that by saying, as they're developing this autonomy, and also they're more mobile, what's interesting is that we as the parents are making that transition ourselves from where the kids were completely dependent on us, right? Like, we were providing everything for them. We could just put them in the little carrier and take them with us, strap them on us. Everything we did, they did with us.
And they were happy to.
They were perfectly happy. They didn't have a choice. Actually, they're so small, right? They really couldn't get around very much. And we're going through, in that toddler stage, going through that transition to a kid who really starts to have their own will and is so much more mobile and is able to do so much more. And we, as the parent, are starting to having to figure out that transition. Both, I recognize now that my child does not want to go somewhere, and it becomes more and more difficult to try to figure out how to get them to go with me rather than just throw them in the carrier. And there's like that, like you were saying, that autonomy that's happening. So there's like this development, this brain development that's happening where they're starting to recognize like, oh, hey, I'm different than you. I can have different ideas, different choices. It's not just you that's getting to choose this stuff. I'm also going to start exerting my own will into this. So it's a real interesting transition for parents. And I think there's some like key ones in the development of kids that really challenges us as parents, because we're going through these changes too. It's not just the kids. And I think we're so focused on the changes the kids are going through that we forget that we as the parent also are going through changes, and we're learning and we're trying to figure this stuff out. And most of the time we've not done this before, or we haven't done it with, you know, if it's a sibling, we haven't done it with this one. This one's different. Or we haven't done it with two, or we haven't done it with three. Like, it's new each time. So it's sometimes tough for us to give ourselves a little bit of a break and realize like, oh, look, I'm figuring this out too. And I'm going through a transition.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I always say that the overarching goal of the toddler years is for your little one to become their own individual and to really develop a sense of self. And this happens as they realize that they're not really an extension of their parents and primary caregivers, that they are in fact their own person that can do their own things. And this is why we see toddlers just have such strong preferences in the toddler years, because they, for the first time, they realize that they can have these likes and dislikes and they have their own agenda. And oh my goodness, is it challenging to have your little one with their own agenda seemingly out of nowhere, and it does not align with your agenda. And then that's where the challenges really come in. And today I know we're talking about building sibling relationships. And I just want to start off by asking you, at what age do you feel that parents and caregivers should really start thinking about sibling relationships and sibling dynamics?
Yeah, honestly, I think it could happen before that second child is born or that second child is adopted, that you can start laying some of that foundation very early on, at least in talking about becoming maybe a big brother or a big sister. Beyond that, certainly after there are two kids, what I like to think about is the older child, your first child, they have never lived in a world where they've had to share you with other people, other siblings. So it's really kind of it's the biggest transition for this first child that you have. Whereas the second child coming along, they're being born into a world or adopted into a family where they already have a sibling. So really maintaining that strong, secure attachment with your first child so that you preserve that relationship that you have with them and they feel safe and seen and soothed by you. My own mom, I'm the second, I'm actually the middle child, but my own mom would talk about how she would leave me, the younger sibling, in my crib, and I would be perfectly content as a little baby. And she would spend time with my big brother because he was the one that needed it rather than me. So I think that's a nice thing to keep in mind when introducing a new sibling into the family is the biggest transition is for the first child, because it's so easy to get wrapped up in the needs of a baby too. And the care and the constant feeding and tending and catching up on sleep. And that is so intense. But don't forget the first child.
Yeah. And we're making a little bit of an assumption here that the older siblings probably toddler-ish age. We're not necessarily talking about an older sibling, much older sibling, but if the older sibling is more toddler-like or toddler age, I think it's super valuable, like you were saying early on, before the baby is born, is to spend that time and develop that really strong foundation, going on one-on-one dates with the oldest with the one toddler, and developing that relationship so they feel really tight and safe and secure and seen. That attachment is really a foundation that is laid before the baby comes along, because there's going to be a lot of time spent, obviously, with the baby. And then the other thing is also to involve the oldest sibling in the whole process and have them feel like they're a part of it, because then they will see that they are a piece of this family and not just an external piece or something that's competing with, but rather they are they're integral into the care and the feeding and the diaper changing and the playing with and all of these things that they can do. And it, of course, depends on the age of the older sibling, but to be able to involve them, hey, can you grab me that diaper over there and bring it over and we'll change that. There's some things they're going to be able to do more than others, but as much as we can involve them in that process, then they feel included and it reinforces that attachment rather than it being a competition with the younger sibling.
Such a great point. And there's so many parents and caregivers asking in my community, asking all the time about this, that I actually created a workshop called Toddler Meets Baby a few months ago to really support parents during this transition of when you bring a little one home or prepare to bring a little one home when you have a toddler. And it's just so great to think about, it's not even, we have so much power, I think, when it comes to supporting the relationship and supporting how the relationship's going to go and laying that foundation, and that it can even happen before a little one comes home, before a sibling comes home, that work can really get started. And I would love to know, like, when you just think about sibling relationships, especially into the toddler years, what are some of the common traps or that parents fall into when it comes to these relationships?
Yeah. Sure, yeah. I think one of the biggest common traps, I'll talk about maybe two, is parents deciding how our conflict is going to get worked out. Like, parents assuming, like, I've got the big picture, I know how to create things and I'll make it fair, and I'll be kind of like the judge and the jury and everything combined. And here, you get this toy for 5 minutes and then you can get it for 5 minutes and I'll come up with a solution, rather than this amazing opportunity we have with even very young, maybe it's even a baby and a toddler, to come together and to find out what is going to work for both people here, even though they're little people. So that's one thing. And we can talk more about specifically how we handle conflict in the future. And then the second thing that I think parents can get trapped into is when there's a conflict, that sometimes, and I can certainly include myself in her too, when there's a conflict, I get flooded, I get triggered, and it's really hard for me to be very present to what's happening because I'm wrapped up in all my own emotions. And so figuring out what I need to do to take a few deep breaths, calm myself first. I even remember when my kids were fighting outside one time, and I locked myself in the bathroom just to give myself a moment, knowing like they're going to be okay. Like they're in a safe place. I need to take a little bit of time for myself. So I took maybe 10 seconds, locked myself in there to just give myself a moment to calm myself down. And then I could go out and be a better parent for them.
The only other trap I would add to that, or a pitfall, is sometimes we as parents get caught up in what's fair. And we hear this often asked of us, is like, well, how do I figure out what's fair? And the kids are saying, that's not fair. And what we talk about often is fair versus equal. And what usually kids are saying is, that's not equal. They're getting that and I didn't get that. And what we talk about in our family, and we coach other parents with, is being a family that's fair. And a family that's fair, we associate it with medicine, for instance. If one kiddo is sick and another one's, you know, perfectly healthy, we wouldn't give them both medicine. We give the child that needs the medicine what they need, and we don't give it to the other one. That would be equal. If we gave it to both of them, that'd be equal. But it's fair that the one that's sick is getting the medicine. In much of the same way, as a parent, we look at how we're going to be parenting a child that's, our kids are different, and we're not going to be treating them the exact same way. One rule, one agreement, one limit that we may have with one child may not apply to another one, because that's what's fair. That's what that child needs. That's who that child is. If it was equal, then it would be the same for everyone. Rules would be rules, and that's it. And that doesn't make a lot of sense, because not all kids are equal. And so I think that's a trap that we as parents get kind of locked into. We start thinking about like, how can I make all this fair, and everything's needs to be the same, and it actually doesn't. And if we're easy on ourselves and we recognize like, no, we give the kids what they need, and that's what's fair.
Yeah, I love that. And it's such a common phrase to hear, especially from an older sibling that, you know, has better command of words. If you're thinking of like maybe having like a 1-year-old and a 3 or 4-year-old at home, or a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, it's a really common phrase to hear. So I love that this is a way that parents can really reframe what they're hearing and translate it into something that's more supportive for everyone. What would you say are just some of the things that parents and caregivers can do to really build that firm foundation in the sibling relationship? Even when, you know, both kiddos are, you know, maybe there's two toddlers and they're both running around and have their own agendas. What's a way that parents can really focus on building that foundation, that relationship, especially inside of what feels like a lot of chaos at the same time?
Yeah. And I also just want to say, like, to everyone who's listening, we understand that there's a lot of chaos that is happening in houses when there are young kids or older kids. And so we have a ton of compassion for that. And remember, days in the preschool classroom when we would just look at each other and be like, oh my gosh, what is happening? We have like 21 3 to 5 year olds. And what are we going to do? So in the midst of those full, emotionally draining, like packed, exciting days, one of the things that I think really builds a strong sibling foundation is how we help kids handle conflict. I really like to look at conflict when I can calm myself down and not get triggered by my own emotions. I really like to look at conflict as this opportunity to grow. It's an opportunity to connect and to understand each other better. And really, like, families are a place where we learn how to get along with each other. It's such an incredible opportunity. So reframing conflict and helping kids figure out how to get through conflict. And we could, should we share some steps about how to do conflict?
Sure. Right now? I think that'd be great.
Okay.
First, I want to say, this is easy for us to talk about. And the truth of the matter, at least for me, was that conflict in the family just gets my hair on top. And it really gets me like going. Like, I get really agitated and it really gets me fired up. And it's been something I've always struggled with when the kids were fighting. But when I was teaching in the classroom and I saw kids fighting, of course, they're not my kids, so it didn't get me as triggered. But I also got to see in the classroom this opportunity to see it as a place or an opportunity for growth. And that was interesting for me. And when I saw that, I was then able to take that and translate that into our home. And so I just want to acknowledge for parents that, like, it really, when there's conflict with our kids, just to acknowledge, like, that's very triggering for us as a parent versus with other kids. And that if we can start to slowly transition into that place of seeing it as an opportunity for growth and an opportunity for connection, it really is transformative for us as a parent, but also for the kids. But I also want to say it's not easy. I think Cecilia is way better at it than I am. She continues to be better at it than I am, but it is something that I think can be really challenging for some parents.
Yeah, I always say practice makes progress. And so it truly is a practice, and it's not going to look perfect, and it's going to grow and evolve. But the good news is we don't have to have it all figured out every moment. And it's about just seeing, like, what worked and what didn't. Give yourself a little bit of compassion, learn the lessons, and try again, because that's the best we can do, is just to keep trying again as we learn and grow.
Totally. Yeah. Did you want to say those steps that you were starting to lead into the steps?
Sure. We could come up with an example and talk about some steps. Would that be helpful for your audience?
Yeah, Devin? I think that'd be great. That's a great place to start for us to address conflicts. I know a lot of people have questions on what to do, especially around things like, you know, grabbing toys or, you know, hitting, things like that. There's endless scenarios for sibling conflict.
Yeah.
Yes. Many opportunities to practice.
Yes. Lots of opportunities every day. So let's think of a scenario where, like, maybe there's a toddler and there's an infant, and the toddler goes and, like, pulls the infant's hair. And that's really triggering for a lot of parents. Anytime that there's any sort of, like, hitting or biting or hair pulling or kicking, it often evokes us a lot as parents. So, as we said before, I think the first step, and you might only have a half of a second to do this, but the first step is really, like, checking in with yourself and doing whatever you can to calm in the moment. Maybe it's saying something to yourself that you've heard us say here today, or heard Devin say before, of, like, that conflict is not an opportunity to grow, or that we're going to work this out, or something that's kind of calming, taking a deep breath, getting a drink of water, whatever it is that can quickly kind of get you grounded, and help then for you to transition into helping get your kids safe. So as you're doing your self-calming, so that's step number one, is kind of checking in with yourself, and you can jump in here if you want to add.
It's okay.
Step number two after that is creating some safety for the kids. So oftentimes what that means for me with young ones is that I'll, like, put an arm around each of them so that they both feel a little connected to me. If we have a baby, or if a child doesn't have a really great command of language, then I'm going to do some of the speaking for them so that they can be represented in this conflict. So I might say something like, how that hurt when you pulled my hair. That's what the baby's saying from crying, saying, she didn't like that. And then for the older child might say something like, oh, hey, I want that toy. I want that rattle that the baby has. Oh, okay. You really want the rattle. And like having a conversation, having a dialogue with both of them so that both sets of needs are brought to the table. I'm understanding their feelings, like that the baby is hurt, and also probably talking with the toddler about, oh gosh, you're really frustrated. You want that rattle. You really like that rattle that the baby has. Okay. How are we going to work this out? So kind of step three would be trying to figure out some solutions. If the toddler or if the kids can't figure out any solutions that are going to work, or if there are no solutions that they're coming up that are going to work for me, then I'm going to offer some of my own. Like, what about if you give this toy to the baby and we'll see if she lets go of the rattle? Let's try that and try a little bit of negotiation to figure out something that will work for both of them.
How about you could, what do you think about if you tapped on my arm and said, hey, I'd like that? Or if you tapped on the baby's arm and said, I want that, but like really giving them other ideas that would meet our need as a parent for safety and the baby's need for comfort and meet the need for the child of communicating what it is they're trying. Because that's what they're pulling the hair, they're hitting, they're kicking. Usually it's a form of communication. And that's what we're trying to do, is to help them find another way to communicate that is meeting everyone's needs.
Yeah. And I like what you talked about, because I was focusing more on like, what can we do in the moment to solve this problem? And you were focusing on how we want a role model for kids in the future that they can solve those similar situations. So I like both of those.
And one of the reasons we talk about this so much, and we spend time in doing this with kids when they've got the conflict, and this isn't fast. I mean, this is something that's going to take a little bit of time, right? Like if we really want a fast conclusion or a fast solution, we all know what to do in those cases. I don't think anyone needs examples of that, right? But when we're trying to do it like this and make it a little bit slower, people are like, well, yeah, it just takes so long. I don't have time for that. I'm busy. I got to do this and this. And why would I want to spend all the time doing this? And the reason is because if we're considering that we're building this foundation and scaffolding them in how to problem solve and scaffolding them into how to have their own conflict resolution, we are actually building a skill for both of them so that in the future, down the line, they don't need us to always be there to resolve conflict. And they don't need us to be there every moment, every time something comes up. Because what will start to happen is not only will they find a different way of interacting that isn't involving us, but if there is some kind of a conflict, that they start to be able to work it out. Now, obviously with an infant, that's going to take a lot longer, but when it's two toddlers, they learn very quickly like, oh, hey, This has already been modeled for us with mom and dad. They've shown us, or our caregiver has shown us how to do this, and they will start to do it themselves. So it's really worth spending that a little bit extra time, because it pays off in the long run. It really does. And sometimes that's hard as a parent who's really busy to keep in mind that it's worth spending that little bit extra time.
Yeah, I mean, teaching skills is one of the most important aspects of discipline. I feel like I have a three-step recipe for effective discipline that I teach a lot of people in my community, and teaching skills is definitely one of them, because it's like the gift that keeps on giving, you know, and we might not see the full benefit of it in this moment, but when we fast forward down the road, then we have a child who has the ability to work through conflict and solve problems, and two kiddos that are able to do that together without having us involved every time, which can be so supportive. And, you know, when it comes to these challenges, it takes some guidance. It takes some time to work through it with kiddos, especially when they're young in the toddler years and really lacking that impulse control. And as you said, like, it can be super triggering for us as the adults. And one thing that I notice is, a lot of times parents and caregivers, and I've done this as well, kind of fall into the habit of making one child the good one, typically the younger one or the one they feel is a little like more helpless or something like this, and one child the quote unquote bad child, which is typically the older one who, you know, quote unquote should know better, or is old enough to know better. And I'm curious your thoughts on why we should avoid, you know, looking at it through this lens and placing these labels on the kiddos when it comes to kind of solving this conflict and teaching them skills for the future.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Our perspective is that whenever there's like hitting or biting or hair pulling or whatever, that's the last resort that a child is using. Like they don't want to use those strategies, but they've tried everything that they can think of doing. And especially if you're a young child, you don't have very many tools in your toolbox. So lashing out and physically trying to do something to solve your problems, it can almost seem like the first resort for parents that are looking at a child like, oh my gosh, why is he hitting again? Or why is she hitting again? So understanding like, that these little guys are doing the best they can with what they have, and that when they know better, that they'll do better. And if they feel good about their relationship with us, and when they feel good about themselves, then they're much more able to have some impulse control and have more patience. But if they're tired or hungry or lonely, or angry, then especially in those times, then you do get behaviors that are harder for kids to manage. So I think first, when you see one kid is like the good kid and one kid is the bad kid, understanding that those behaviors are like a tragic attempt to meet a need. They're really trying hard. They don't know what else to do. And it's our parenting, our support, and other caregivers' parenting and support that's going to help them build the skills so that they don't have to do that in the future.
And I think what some parents have said to us is that it's hard for them. Like it just naturally is there. It's like immediate. They're like, I feel like I can't help myself. And I just see like one seems like they're the one who's causing all the problems. And I just fell into this like the good child, bad child kind of like judgment. And one of the things that we suggest is to be regularly going on one-on-one dates with your kid, like have one-on-one time with them. And maybe that's just, you know, as a toddler, maybe that's just spending some time playing Legos with them without the sibling around, that it's just your time. And your goal during that time is just to connect. And that builds that foundation of relationship with them, not just for their sake, but also for your sake as a parent, because you start to see them differently. We start to have a different view of them. And to be able to do that with both of them helps in developing that attachment with the parent, which actually helps in the relationship between the siblings, because they're no longer trying to compete for our attention or our relationship, but then all of a sudden they're more comfortable with being with each other. So it's a little counterintuitive. People don't quite get that usually. And it's not something you immediately think of like, oh, I should spend more time with each of them separately so they get along better, but it really does help in that attachment model.
And I think, does it also help with how we view our child too? Yeah, like when we're
that's kind of
them.
What I was hinting at. Yeah. Our image of that child starts to shift because we start to see, oh, you know, they're trying the best they can. This is their challenge that they've got. Or, oh, now I see their perspective. It just gives us a different view of them, and it helps develop our attachment to them and our relationship with them as well.
Like seeing that child for who they really are, seeing the gold in them, seeing their superpowers, reframing stubbornness or what looks like defiance. It's like, wow, my child is very persistent, or they're very assertive. Constantly like looking at how am I viewing that child? Because those thoughts that we have about our kids, even if we don't articulate them out loud, they come across to our children. And in the classroom, it was part of our work was to really understand what made the tough kids tick, the kids that were more behaviorally challenging. Certainly we were doing that in our own home too, but it was those kids that were really, really tough. Like, we just had to like understand them and love them even more so that we didn't get into that trap of thinking, oh, that's the bad kid. So yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. A great tool I like to share with parents is just to practice looking for the good. So, you know, really practice looking for the behavior that you want to see, because the more that we focus on that behavior and can find it, the more often we'll see it. Because a lot of times it doesn't mean that it's not happening, but because the behavior that we typically don't want to see can feel so triggering, it just somehow like automatically in our mind erases all those other moments where things were going well. And so I always like to make it a point to find that behavior that we want to see and, you know, really look at how we can shift the lens out of, you know, labeling one child good or bad, or one as like the aggressor or the victim. Because, you know, what I found is that whenever we really focus on those roles, not only do kids pick up on it, it tends to reinforce those roles. So then kids kind of start to feel stuck and like, you know, the one that is like the good child or maybe like the victim, and then somehow like thinks, well, gosh, there's nothing I can do to have this go differently. And then the other child is like, oh, well, I guess this is just how I deal with things. And I just feel like that, you know, the more that we can shift our lens in these moments and just practice slowly shifting this lens, then the easier it's going to be for everyone to navigate the conflicts that come up.
Yeah, I actually, there was an exercise I've done over many times during the lifetime of being a parent at different ages with our kids to kind of combat that negative bias that we have, that negativity bias where you were just describing of where that one thing that happens that's negative just blows out like all the good that's happened, right? We're just like, it's all we get stuck on. It's like, oh, it's so terrible. And it's just been this one piece compared to everything else. And I started for an extended period of time, I would wake up in the morning and the first things I would go through were positive things that I had seen my child do, and just practicing that and developing a habit of that. And that was something that, and I would, when they got older, I would actually just, you know, kind of comment to them like, hey, I noticed that you did such and such the other day, and just like communicating that with them. Cause most likely, especially as they're getting older, they know when we've got that kind of that negative view of them. And if we're starting to give them that positive feedback, that also helps to reinforce how we feel about them in our relationship. And so that was an exercise I took on for a while and have done that, needed to do that a few times over the years.
Yeah, that's so supportive. And I'm curious, when I know for myself, like I'm a very linear thinker. And so I know what really helps for a lot of people with a toddler and sometimes a baby at home or multiple toddlers at home is to kind of be able to kind of map out what everyone's role is. And I just would love for you to talk a little bit about, or like underscore, like if we're looking at all the tips and all the things you've talked to us about today, what do you feel the parent's role really is inside of the sibling conflict?
That's a really interesting question. I think the parent's role is making sure that both of the kids' voices are heard. Whether that's the younger child who doesn't have as good of a grasp on language, making sure that voice is heard, or maybe it's the older child that we are having an expectation like, come on, you're older, you can like have more flexibility, you can give up yourself a little bit more, but being able to like support them, and maybe something just really isn't working for them. That it's okay for them to not feel like they have to give up all the time to accommodate the younger child. So I think it's helping both of those voices be heard so that we really can come up with a solution that's going to work for both. Some of the things that we would say in our family when our kids were young, especially, is that you guys don't have to give up yourself for this. But we're a family. We figure out what's going to be a win-win for everyone. What are your ideas? How can we find out something that's going to work for both of you and for me, us parents too?
Yeah. Win-win solutions, I think, are like one of the keys that we as parents need to bring to the conversation. And at the core of that is the needs that everyone's needs are being met. There's a lot of other things we could talk about, but that's like, if there was one that I'd pull away from, that's win-win solutions.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. And, you know, after conflict comes the opportunity to apologize and move on. And it's important for a lot of parents and caregivers to feel like siblings have made amends or somehow apologize. And I'm curious, what are your tips for helping parents support kids in making amends with each other, but in a way that is authentic and not just more robotic because they have to?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is a big topic that we hear often.
Yeah. And I love that you asked us about this because it's something I feel really passionate about, that I don't think forced apologies do anybody any good. We're actually just teaching our kids it's okay to lie.
Building resentment, maybe. It does a good job.
Yeah. Building resentment. So robotic apologies are not what we're wanting. Well, I think what we're wanting as parents and caregivers is for our kids to reflect on what happened and to think, what could I have done differently? What do I wish I had done? If I could like go back in time in a time machine, to think about that. So that's, I think, one of the other roles that we have as parents is helping our kids think about what happened in a conversation, not in like a you're in a timeout, go think about, you know, what you would do differently next time way. Because kids that are in timeouts, they aren't going to think about that. They're just going to be like mad at their parents that put them in the timeout or trying to figure out how to like be more sneaky next time. But in a dialogue way of like, if we could go in a time machine, what would you do differently? Or what could you do next time you want the toy that your brother or sister has? So them thinking about alternatives, I think it's part of it. And then whatever small act that they can do, if they tore the page of the book, maybe they can put tape on that page that they tore, that the book that belonged to their sibling. If they can draw a picture and give that picture to their sibling to reconnect, like a small gesture.
Yeah. And I think the role that we're trying to do in amends is we're building empathy, right? We're working with them to try and put themselves in the other person's place. And at the toddler years, that's a tough thing for them doing. That's one of their skills they're building. That's what they're figuring out is like, oh, what they're experiencing is different than what I'm experiencing, because for much of their life, they just think everyone's experiencing the same thing and understands the same thing I understand it. And it's everyone's everyone. And this is something where we're needing to support them in developing that empathy. So we can start to do things like, you know, if someone falls down, maybe if they push the kids, their sibling down and they scrape their knee, like, oh, hey, quick, go grab an ice pack, bring it on over here. And we'll take care of that. Like having them be a part of trying to support their sibling in feeling better or healing or doing whatever it might be. Those small acts can help them start to see like what their impact has been on the other sibling. And then the probably one of the things that I think we forget as parents is we can role model for them when things happen with us and them. And if I do something that I'm like, wow, I wish I would have done that differently. I wish I wouldn't have, you know, yelled before we left trying to get out the door because no one had their shoes on. I wish I wouldn't have yelled. And so I can come back outside that moment, maybe later in the day, and say, you know, guys, earlier in the day when we were trying to leave, and I remember when I yelled and because no one had their shoes on, I wish I could have done that differently. And like actually role model for them what it looks like to have amends. And we noticed this. We actually heard this and saw this happen with our kids where we, you know, things like this would happen as a parent. We do things we wish we would have done them differently. We have regrets. We have amends that we make. And we heard our kids start to apologize to each other spontaneously using the same format that we were using with them because they had had it role modeled and they had the words and they knew like how that would play out and what they would do. So I think we as parents need to remember that we can be a really big piece of that puzzle when it happens with us, and to remember that, like, hey, we're fallible in the same way. We can make mistakes and we can apologize for them too. And it's good for the kids to see that.
Yeah, that's such a great point that, you know, one of the best ways to really model these types of, to teach these type of skills is through modeling them. And so this is a really great point. And, you know, I always say that you know, for a child to apologize to another child, we really have to help them feel better before they can help someone else feel better. So if that child is still upset about what happened, you know, like if a child hit another child, the one who hit, if they still have, like maybe the child that got hit has a physical hurt, but maybe the child who did the hitting has more of an emotional hurt or need there. And if we haven't soothed and supported that, then it's going to be really hard for them to authentically, you know, help another child feel better. And so I think like this further just underscores, you know, why it's not just, it's important to get away from this idea of like labeling one child as good and one child as bad, because in that situation, both kids are having a hard time or having some type of hurt. And so we've got to address both of those. Like you said, we have to hear both children's voices. And I think that's so important if we ever want to get to more of an authentic apology.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So for parents and caregivers at the beginning of their journey, thinking about building strong sibling relationships, what's one action step that they can take today just to really start out on their journey and move the needle forward?
Yeah. And when you say starting out on their journey, are you saying like with a young child, or that they're kind of like new to this kind of peaceful parenting, or maybe even both?
Well, it could be both, but more so new to the idea of that. I hear what you're saying. This is such an important topic, and I want to make a difference in my children's relationship and really start focusing on how to support them to really build that strong relationship. So where would you recommend that they get started?
Yeah. If there's not a conflict that's happening, I think one of the easiest things to do, and there's a couple of reasons why it's beneficial to do it, is I love Dan Siegel's he used to say name it to tame it. Now he says name it to frame it, which is basically when we name emotions that we're having or that our kids might be having, that it helps calm down. Actually, neurologically helps calm down the amygdala, the emotional centers of our brain. So that's one reason why we want to do that. The second reason is that it also builds our emotional vocabulary, builds our kids' emotional vocabulary. So that's an easy way to start incorporating some of these concepts that we've been talking about here and in the conference in your daily life. So that could be as simple as you have an infant that is pre-verbal, you're changing their diaper, they start to cry, and you're saying, oh, this feels uncomfortable. You don't like all that cold air on your bum. Here, we're going to do this, and then we're going to make sure that you are nice and comfortable. Talking about their feelings. For the child who's hit the other sibling, oh, that you are so angry. You really want that toy. This didn't go the way you wanted it to. And to the other child that got hit, ow, that hurts so bad. You're feeling really hurt. So again, it helps calm down our emotional brain and helps build the emotional vocabulary.
It also helps build our empathy for our kids, because we start to put ourselves into their shoes. We're like, oh, what are they feeling? And it's modeling for them having empathy for each other. So those are the empathies, one of the keys in what we teach about parenting. And this is a nice way to be able to do that.
And I would say also do that for yourself. Yeah. Like name what feeling is happening for yourself. Like, oh, I'm feeling really frustrated because we're trying to get out the door and nobody has their shoes on. I'm feeling anxious. This isn't working for me. Having that calming, soothing self-talk, naming emotions, is a really great place to start.
Yeah, I love it. I typically recommend for parents and caregivers to start with themselves, especially if they find themselves having trouble doing it for their kiddos. It oftentimes means that we haven't already done it for ourselves. And there's, I think, just so much to be gained when we take that time to kind of walk ourselves through our feelings and emotions, because we're human too. And our feelings and emotions are just as valid as everyone else's. And I think sometimes we tend to forget that as parents and caregivers, and you know, our own needs and feelings and emotions kind of get pushed down or go to the wayside. And so that's such a powerful first step, I feel, that everyone can take. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
So, you know, our time's coming to a close. I'm just curious if there's anything else you'd like to add or any final words of wisdom you'd like to leave us with about sibling relationships.
Well, actually, it's along the lines of what you were just saying, that it's so important for us as a parent to be taking care of ourselves. And I think we forget that, especially when we're really busy, when the kids are young, and there's lots going on. And I think part of that is understanding how to find calm for ourselves and calm for the kids. Because, you know, we really don't want the kids to have to rely on us for absolutely everything, right? So the more we can model and the more tools we can put into place so they don't need us, the easier our load becomes. And also the more that we're able to identify for ourselves, how can we find some calm in the midst of all the craziness? So one of the things that we'll have here also available for you is a calming plan. We make that available to the people here in the conference. And it's a free plan to go through for everyone. And if this is for like everyone in the family, to go through and to fill out, like, what are the things that make you feel calm? And it's not about, there's lots of great examples in it so that you don't have to think of it all by yourself just with a blank slate. But what's great about it is there's lots and lots of examples. And for me, what helps calm me is listening to music and going for a walk, getting outside. Sometimes I can do that. Sometimes I can't. The other things that help calm me is just some nice cool water on my face. And I can identify those things. And each person in the family makes that list of what calms them, put it on the fridge. And then when we're getting a little triggered or a little upset and we want to calm, we, the adult, can go and look. Or if our kids need it, they can go and look. Or we can prompt them to say, hey, remember that calming list thing we put together and it's on the fridge? Why don't you go check that out? And it can be made with pictures, so it's not just words. So whatever it works for them to be able to read. And maybe there's a basket that has the things in it. Maybe they like a feather or maybe a ball to squeeze or something that they've identified as being calming for them. That is so pivotal for them to be able to start to identify and build a skill around how to calm themselves, because then they don't need us as much. Not only can they help calm themselves, but they can go and figure out the things that calm themselves because you guys did the work and you created this calming plan. So that's one thing that I would highly suggest putting into place, kind of like a foundation. That's just a nice, easy thing to do. It can be connecting as a family, and it's great for the kids to see like, oh, hey, this applies to mom and dad too, or my caregivers. Like, they need it just as much as I do. And this is great. And I remember our kids reminding us of like, hey, dad, maybe you want to check out your calming plan. So it's actually really nice to kind of level the playing field for everyone in the family. And obviously it's very useful.
I love that. It's so generous. And I know that everyone's going to really appreciate that. And before we go, can you just let us know where everyone can find you if they want to continue the conversation?
Sure. The easiest way is our website. So happilyfamily.com, happily family, like happily ever after. And you can find out everything about us and courses and a lot of free content that we have in there.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I just want to thank you both for taking the time to be here today and to share all of your wisdom and expertise with us all. I truly appreciate you and the work that you're doing in this world.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. It's great to be here.
It's great to be here.
Thank you. And before I go, I'd like to invite all of you to join the discussion thread for this session in the Transforming Toddlerhood Facebook group. We'd love to hear your thoughts, questions, and feedback. Can't wait to connect with you there. And don't forget to upgrade to the premium package so you can access the bonus materials for the conference and listen to this session and all the others again and again. Well, until next time, we'll see you soon. Bye.